This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailhartz on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon. On the program today, a global pandemic, souring trade relations, closed borders. If you do look back on the past year, we've seen a lot of change. And you might think, well, that's going to have to lead to a pretty bad year for agriculture. But remarkably, it seems that largely that's not the case, not for everybody, but broadly speaking. So we'll find out if and how ag has been dodging bullets this year. Also today, the dairy industry's national advocacy body, Australian Dairy Farmers, is now recruiting only weeks after its AGM. We'll find out why. Start today, though, trade tensions are continuing with China. Overall, there are 8 Australian abattoirs now waiting to resume trade with China, including the Caboolture Meatworks, Merrimust, which has been delisted so far without any apparent reason this week, but also 2 Victorian abattoirs, the JBS plant at Brooklyn and Australian Lamb Company at Colac. Now, they delisted themselves earlier this year because of coronavirus outbreaks, but haven't since relisted. Parliament House reporter Kath Sullivan explains the latest.
Well, it's interesting, Nikolai. We heard from Patrick Hutchinson yesterday about the damage that these suspensions to the trade with China have caused the red meat industry. He ballparked it at around about a third of the trade. In fact, I think more specifically, year-on-year sales are down 27%. Now, that compares to about 13% of the global meat trade. So there is specifically something going wrong with China. And we've known about the initial 4 Australian abattoirs, 3 in Queensland, 1 in New South Wales, where the trade was stopped back in May over labelling concerns. The John Dee Abattoir in Queensland was in August added to that list, this time over concerns that an antibiotic had been traced in meat from that abattoir. Of course, this week, Merrimust at Caboolture, not a very big player in terms of Australia's exports to China, but now we know that it's been stopped. We don't, however, know why. But interesting that there are 2 Victorian abattoirs that have also been caught out, and it's worth having a look at JBS Brooklyn and the Australian Lamb Company at Colac. Their circumstances are a little bit different because they voluntarily delisted from the trade with China when coronavirus was detected in staff at those meat processing plants. Now, this actually took place, I think it was JBS first and then ALC, but they were about a week apart back in July.
Yeah, and that, like you say, that was a while ago. So what's happened now?
Those abattoirs, I understand, are trying to get back on the list, back to sending product to China. It's my understanding that at the time, I'm not sure if you can think back that far. I know it's been a long year, Nikolai, but we knew that China had introduced global protocols saying that it wanted a certificate of authenticity or that anybody exporting to China could prove that their food hadn't been contaminated with the coronavirus. And at that, it was around about at that time that there were meat producers across species that across the world who voluntarily said, we won't sell product into China if we've had an outbreak detected in our staff. Speaking to Simon Quilty, friend of the program, meat industry analyst based in Victoria, he said there's been about 66 odd abattoirs across the world that took that decision to end the trade with China since the coronavirus pandemic, but so far half of those have been relisted, and he thought the average time to get relisted was around about 50 days. Now, I can tell you, I'm not that good at maths, but it's been more than 50 days since the middle of July when those 2 Victorian abattoirs announced those detections and stood aside. So we heard from Patrick Hutchinson yesterday, while he didn't name the abattoirs, that industry is really concerned about this and wants to resume the trade as soon as possible. And when you do add it all up, I mean, that's 8 abattoirs now hoping to resume trade with China, our biggest market for red meat. And, well, we heard from the Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, yesterday. Well, he's saying there are still 36 abattoirs that are selling meat to China in Australia, something he was keen to point out.
As you mentioned too, so the Australian Meat Industry Council saying that these disruptions have cost hundreds of millions of dollars. But how do we know that it's not potentially other things, things like drought, the cost of production, people eating at home rather than going out so much?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because Patrick Hutchinson was happy to list those things as contributing to perhaps a downturn in jobs in the sector, but was more adamant that China had the suspensions to the trade there had cost it hundreds of millions of dollars. And when we think, you know, almost $3 billion worth of sales last year, it's not out of the question. And that largely comes back to those stats saying year on year, almost 30% of sales to China are down, compared to almost 10% globally. So there is definitely something up when it comes to China.
That is our Parliament House reporter, Kath Sullivan. Well, meanwhile, the Federal Trade Minister, Simon Birmingham, is growing visibly frustrated with the Chinese government, which is still refusing to answer his calls. And that is an obligation they have to communicate as part of the Chinese-Australia Free Trade Agreement, also known as CHAFTA. Well, today, the minister announced the World Trade Organization is now officially involved in the dispute. Here he is detailing that in the Senate.
The Australian government has become increasingly concerned about a series of trade, disruptive and restrictive measures implemented by the Chinese government on a wide range of goods imported from China, and that these disruptions have increased significantly in recent months. The Chinese government has publicly stated that these disruptions are due to legitimate trade remedies, biosecurity measures, as well as non-compliance with other technical standards. They have included measures implemented through the operation of Chinese regulations on quality, labelling, safety and pest and disease inspections. In the view of the Australian government, the targeted nature of Chinese government measures on Australian goods raises concerns about China's adherence to the letter and spirit of both its CHAFTA and its WTO obligations. Australia has raised these concerns with Chinese officials on multiple occasions in both Canberra and in Beijing, and has asked the Chinese government to engage on these matters at officials and ministerial levels. The Chinese government has consistently spoken about its commitment to open trade and the multilateral trading system, as well as to its free trade agreements, including CHAFTA. All WTO members are expected to conduct their trading relationships in a manner consistent with their international obligations. We have raised our concerns about the Chinese government's measures in the WTO, including most recently at the 25 November 2020 meeting of the WTO Committee on Trade in Goods. We raised at that committee our concerns in respect to barley, to wine, meat and dairy establishments, live seafood exports, logs, timber, coal and cotton. Only yesterday, the Chinese government, through its customs agency, the General Administration of Customs of the PRC, notified Australian agricultural officials of a further suspension of a meat processing facility, Merrimast, in Caboolture. The Australian government has raised its concerns with the Chinese government's anti-dumping and countervailing duties investigations into imports of Australian barley, and has expressed our view that the Chinese government's processes, analysis and findings were inconsistent with WTO rules. CHAFTA includes a structure of regular meetings intended to create an ongoing dialogue between Australia and China, and a built-in agenda of reviews which provide avenues to address issues and increase two-way trade opportunities. After a reasonable start in bilateral engagement, in recent years, the Chinese government's lack of engagement has prevented the use of these structures. Australia remains committed to building on the gains already achieved under CHAFTA, and we will continue to advocate for its timely and effective implementation, including those consultation mechanisms, for the benefit of businesses and consumers in both Australia and China. Our government continues to work closely with our exporters in an effort to retain preferential market access into China, which has delivered such widespread gains to date, and we continue to raise issues of apparent or potential discriminatory actions targeted against Australia. The Australian government is considering all dispute settlement options in order to support our exporters and to ensure they can compete on fair terms. Deputy President, turn to the second point of the motion, the extent and consequences of Australian economic dependence on the Chinese market. It is a fact that China is Australia's largest trading partner, accounting for around 29% of our total two-way trade in 2019-20. Over the same period, China accounted for around 35% of Australia's total goods and services exports. Australia's exports to China reflect the complementarity of our economies and meet many of China's needs, including for resources, energy, food and tourism, and education services. Australian businesses have capitalised on these opportunities, and in doing so, they have made their own choices about markets, reliance and risk. The Australian government is committed, of course, to expanding opportunities in other markets. Australian businesses will continue to export to markets where Australian products and services are in demand and where profits are highest relative to risks.
That is the Federal Trade Minister, Simon Birmingham.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 16 past 12. Australia's dairy industry is already losing business to its number one export market. Perhaps unsurprisingly, that too is China. And while its trade spat with other agricultural commodities has been the focus so far, barley, wine, lobster, exports for key dairy products like infant formula have fallen this year by more than 40%. Warwick Long spoke to Director of Dairy Consultancy Fresh Agenda, Steve Spencer, who says this could only be the beginning.
We've built a very strong dependence on dairy into China. The industry was very happy to be part of a free trade agreement in 2015, which opened up access. And we've seen a huge amount of dedication to increasing infant milk formula exports into that market. And the industry is well placed as a premium supplier into that market. You know, there's a lot of organic product. We've got a bit of A2 going in there, but we are, high-spec product going into the top end of the market, and we're achieving a higher unit value than anyone else. So that's nearly half our trade by value in dairy is the infant formula category. So it's very serious.
And how important is China to Australia's dairy exports? Is it our number one export market? It's
absolutely our number one export market. The next market is, that's more than three times the size of the next market. As a single country, yeah.
There's been a lot of thought that China, in this trade argy-bargy, I suppose, for want of a better term, that we find ourselves in at the moment, has picked commodities that are almost expendable to the Chinese consumer or something that it can get somewhere else. Where does dairy sit in that relationship with China?
Look, you have to say we're fairly vulnerable because we have a small share of the dairy market into China. We've got a small share of the infant formula trade, the highest value product, but we're dwarfed by Europe has more than 70% of the infant formula trade. We've got one-fifth of that in the 2019 numbers by value.
So we're not essential?
We're not essential. I suppose it comes down to why the consumer in China has supported the Australian product because, we know all the stories about, and I'm only talking about official trade in the numbers that you've seen, Warwick, but there is an unofficial grey trade or, the Daigou trade which goes up through personal shoppers, which adds a bit more to what's going on in Australia. It's impossible to measure. But that's coming from direct preferences of consumers, and Chinese consumers have been very strongly supportive of Australian brands and the Australian quality mark. So that's an important factor here because we've differentiated ourselves as a supplier with the food quality and safety systems that the industry has built here over many, many years.
Is the industry prepared or is Australian dairy set up to weather the storm if dairy is one of the products that gets enveloped in this China trade war?
Look, we have a diverse set of markets, I guess, Warwick. There's lots of markets we sell to. This high exposure in infant formula is one that I would say some players aren't well set up for because there aren't big IMF markets out there other than China. It is the dominant market. So that's one risk. I mean, we are well set up. We've got a diverse, set of marketers and a set of markets to put product into, but it will hurt. Something I would just point out, I mean, we're talking about when when dairy comes into this or when this envelops dairy, it's already well and truly enveloped because the slowdown in trade has, you know, it started in the middle of last year. And our trade in infant formula alone into China is down more than 40% so far this year, year on year, to do a direct comparison. So it's already happening.
And you think that's going to continue?
I think it's, it's well on the way. I think the trends are well set. The year-on-year declines in trade have slowed a bit. So, you know, some categories aren't being affected. Cheese is still quite strong and cheese is still growing. So it will be quite selective. That's a hard bit to call. Just how that's playing out on the docks and in the airports where product's being received. That's where some of the action is.
And if the China market was put on hold, would that put pressure on farm gate prices in Australia, given, I suppose, we're more of a domestic industry than an export industry at the moment?
Yeah, it's going to take some of the gloss off. You know, the difference between commodity prices and what we're achieving in farm gate prices, there's a whole lot of places where we capture a bit more value, and this is one of them. So it will add a bit of pressure to that.
That's Director of Dairy Consultancy Fresh Agenda, Steve Spencer, speaking with Warwick Long. Interesting text through on this as well from Craig. He says Australian exports of dairy heifers is a reason that the Chinese won't burn Australian dairy that's often overlooked. If you would like to get in touch, 0467 842 722 is the text number, 0467 842 722. Well, while there are some challenges for dairy, red meat is quite a different situation. Chinese imports of meat are up 63% on the last year. In a pretty strong signal, the country still has a long way to go when it comes to recovering from African swine fever. However, at the same time, massive industrialised breeding facilities are popping up around the country, the biggest of which will house more than 80,000 sows. Our reporter Angus Verley spoke with market analyst Matt Dalgleish about demand and production dynamics for meat in China.
I mean, last year was a big year for meat imports of all types into China, due to the large void they had in their pork herd from ASF, and this year we've seen that continue. So as of the end of November, if you look at all volumes of imports of meat into China, year-to-date compared from start of the year to November last year to this year, they're up by about 63%. So, up 63% on already a very strong year from 2019. So showing that they've still got a significant appetite to and a significant void to continue to fill.
And I think total imports, almost 9 million tonnes. That's a pretty incredible amount of meat.
Yeah, huge amount, yes. Even though, I mean, the estimates of what the deficit was going to be this year was to the tune of nearly 25 million tonnes. So those volumes are significant volumes, but they've still got a void there. Such was the huge decline in their pork herd due to ASF. They have a big hole to fill, and I think we've said quite a few times at Thomas Elder Markets that there's not one meat commodity nor one country that'll be able to fill that void in its entirety.
So does this then suggest that China is still a long way from resolving that protein or that pork shortage?
There has been some reporting and suggestion that the pork herd was back to within 10% of pre-ASF levels. That came out a month or so ago, and I was quite sceptical about the speed at which, certainly they're throwing a lot at it to get it back up and running again. But, if you look at the price movement for pork, that hasn't backed off at all, really. Indeed, the last month or so, it's increased another 10% pork prices within China. So that's an economic signal that there's still a shortage. But then, looking at the volumes that are going into the country in terms of import volumes, they have not backed off at all either. So that would suggest, despite what's being said about the rebuild and the pace of the rebuild of their pork herd, they've definitely still got a huge deficit they're trying to make up. So I guess, from our perspective at Thomas Elder Markets, we'd rather look at what is actually happening in terms of price and movement of goods as to what's going on the ground in China, rather than taking on face value what they're saying is happening. I think, their actions are speaking louder than their words, and certainly the price action and the volume of imports coming into the country in terms of meat product are showing that they've still got a shortage there.
But, Matt, it does seem that the herd is being rebuilt at a pretty exceptional rate. I was looking just this morning at some pictures of a pig farm being built by Moyuan Foods, one of those, I think, referred to as pig hotels, or there were 21 of them, I think, massive sort of multi-storey apartment block-looking buildings. So when those sorts of industrial constructions are taking place, isn't the herd going to be rebuilt very quickly?
You could say that, Angus. I guess when you look at the structure of their herd pre-ASF, only about 15% of the pork herd was in those big commercial type structures. So 85% was, you know, more smaller scale, for want of a better term, backyard type producers. So that's a big transition to change, you know, the whole of the industry across to a much more commercial system. Certainly, look, if there's a country that's going to be able to do it and do it quickly, China is one of those that are used to those kind of big grand scale planning schemes. But again, they're not something that happens overnight. And those hotels in question, I think some of them have been quoted as holding up to 80,000 sows, breeding sows. And so you're talking a kind of structure of that size. You're probably looking at about 3 million or so pigs that could be produced per annum out of it. But we're talking about a deficit of 200 million or so pigs from ASF. So that's a big hole to fill. So I think it's going to be probably, my estimate would be at least, you know, 3 years on the good side to be able to get to this, you know, back to pre-ASF levels. And we're probably a year and a half in, so I'd suggest we've probably got another year and a half before we're kind of back to seeing more normality in terms of both price for pork in China and also some reduced volumes of imports of meat product.
And I suppose that's assuming that ASF doesn't take hold again, but these pig hotels are extremely densely populated, and ASF is still in China and there is still no vaccine for it. So what's the risk that it becomes rampant in these highly densely populated facilities?
That was the tricky part about the original, when the virus first hit China, was that the nature of their pork industry was that it was quite susceptible. These hotels, I believe, are on a much higher standard in terms of biosecurity, so that may help. And if you look at some of the Western countries that have got a high production capacity for pork, like Denmark and Germany, ASF is in Germany now in the wild boar population, but it hasn't really made any impact into the German pork production area because of those biosecurity measures. And Australian producers have very similar strict biosecurity measures. So these new Chinese facilities, I would suggest, are going to have pretty strict biosecurity measures that will help keep ASF out. But as you said, it's still endemic in China. It's still, you know, it's a very virulent virus, so it can last on surfaces for many weeks. So it is going to be something that's going to be hard to eradicate. And so the risk is that, yeah, certainly for the pork producers in China that are still not having the highest of standard of biosecurity, they're going to be susceptible. And any kind of flare-up with those kind of crowded conditions as well in some of these places, any kind of flare-up will kind of decimate the herd in regionalised areas. So that's an ongoing risk, I think.
Just finally, Matt, meat producers here in Australia, should they be looking at these massive pig hotels with concern about what they may mean for demand for Australian meat going forward?
I don't think so. I think it's, you know, we're probably not going to see, like I said, those supercharged levels of demand we've seen. Certainly last year was a very much an out-of-the-box year. This year we've seen it come off a little bit, like I said, for beef. Sheep meat's still very strong, but if you consider the dynamic of the global sheep meat picture, you know, Australia and New Zealand are the two main suppliers to the world. So sheep meat's one where we've got a natural advantage. There's not a lot of competitors in that space, whereas beef, we have got quite a few competitors that China could go elsewhere for product. But I think broadly speaking, you know, it's not just from a more global demand perspective, I guess, it won't just be China that the Australian producer will have opportunities. You know, we've just recently signed the free trade agreement with Indonesia, you know, the fourth most populous country in the world. So, you know, there's lots of options there for the Australian producer, you know, even with China being able to supply some of their domestic needs more adequately in future years once they get their pork herd back up and running. You know, China will still be a big client, and there's a load of others. You know, the beauty of the red meat space for the Australian producer is that the market, both markets for sheep meat and beef, are very diversified markets that have a lot of opportunities for us.
It's Matt Dalgleish from Thomas Elder Markets speaking with Angus Verley. Australian stockpiles of wool could be a black cloud hanging over the market next year, according to one of Australia's only wool processors. At the moment, Australia has up to 350,000 bales of wool in warehouses and on farm due to decreased demand and reduced selling days because of COVID. Michelle Wool CEO Stephen Reid says that could put a dampener on the market once Europeans and the USA start buying Australian wool again.
Well, it's always tough to get a gauge because we get pretty good numbers, Lucas, on what's in brokers' warehouses and private treaty warehouses and warehouses like ours, I guess. But what we don't know is what's on farm. But it is somewhere between 315 and 350,000 bales. And to put that in perspective, for the last 9 months, the wool industry has sold, either at auction or privately, about 32,000 bales a week. So it's significant. It's well up on what we've seen in recent years, but it's not completely ridiculous.
And is that, when you say that, is that just the amount that's being stored on farm, or is that in with all those brokers' warehouses and your warehouses and such?
All together, Lucas. That's all together. So if you're a buyer and the buyers in Europe, the buyers in India, the buyers in China, look back at that, and the numbers are relatively transparent, and you know, we've got pass-in rates that are published every day. They're aware that there's probably 10 weeks of wool that's sitting out there that are in the hands of growers, and they can, with a click of a finger, turn that into cash, which would potentially dump big supplies onto the market. And it is a bit of a black cloud, if you want to use that terminology, hanging over the market at the moment.
Wool has taken a pretty big hit from the demand side of things. Do you think that this black cloud is really going to have any effect if there's not enough demand going around?
Well, it's really in the hands of wool growers. You know, some growers are refusing to sell. And interestingly enough, some of the bigger wool growers are simply following their normal selling programs and turning their wool into cash. Some of the very small wool growers are doing the same, but it's that middle-sized family farm that might have other income from mixed properties, mixed farming properties, that are saying, no, we'll wait till next year and see how things go. And the point you make is dead right. Now, wool prices now are, on a five-year basis, at the lowest level they've been. So there might be an element of, I don't want to sell at this price, I don't need the cash. But that could change in spring when people get back to cropping and other activities.
And you mentioned your own warehouses there. I just want to know, what is Michelle Wool doing in terms of getting wool stockpiles? Are you stockpiling up, or are you just trying to get it out? What are you actually doing?
Well, we wear two hats. We're a processor, so whatever we sell, we buy, we process, and we ship. A few of our customers are delaying orders, which is fine. Interest rates aren't ridiculous, so we can deal with that. So, and a lot of the other hat, of course, is being a buyer and broker on behalf of growers. And it is interesting. We've got some fairly significant warehouses here at Salisbury. They're jam-packed full, and we've been lining up 40-foot containers in the car park of wool we produce for customers that we'll store for 2 or 3 months. So even if you drove into our driveway, Lucas, out here at Salisbury, you'd say, boy, there's wool everywhere. And that is an element of both international customers slowing deliveries and also growers saying, well, I want to send it in, I want to get it tested, I want to know what it's worth, but then I'll sit back and reserve my right to sell it at a later stage.
You mentioned before that this was a black cloud hanging over the market. So not to sound too negative, but I just want to know, when you say it's a black cloud, what do you mean by that?
Well, simply supply exceeds demand at the moment. Whenever that's the case, you've just got to keep your wits about you. If demand exceeded supply and wool was in short supply, you'd be far more optimistic. But I just don't think growers are going to have a change in sentiment and suddenly dump wool on the market. I don't think that's going to be the case.
That is Michelle Wool CEO Stephen Reid speaking with Lucas Forbes. 27-1 on the country. Our time to get the latest in news headlines now with Rio Davis. Afternoon, Rio.
Thanks, Nikolai. Making news, an opposition attempt to block a toxic dump at Bacchus Marsh has narrowly failed in state parliament. The opposition had tried to revoke planning approval for Mattingley Brown Coal to store contaminated soil from the West Gate Tunnel. But the plan was defeated 19 votes to 18 in the upper house, with the government winning support from Fiona Patten and two Liberal Democrat MPs. The Anglican Bishop of the Diocese of Bendigo has criticised the state government's bill criminalising conversion therapy before the parliament this week. Bishop Matt Brain says many religious people are concerned parts of the bill will regulate areas of normal religious life previously unregulated by government. But the co-founder of the Brave Network, Nathan Despot, says the bill has been the result of extensive research and consultation and must pass the Parliament in full. The Victorian Department of Education has confirmed the executive principal of the Greater Shepparton Secondary College has resigned from her position 2 years after she stepped in to lead the school. Teachers took industrial action earlier in the week to express frustration at the rollout of the four-school merger. The SES incident controller for the Horsham North tornado has praised the flexibility of volunteers who responded to a car accident last night in addition to their clean-up work. A woman in her 50s and a man in his 40s were both taken to the Wimmera Base Hospital in a stable condition after a two-car collision. An energy market analyst estimates the growth in renewable energy could force the closure of the Yallourn Power Station in Victoria's east by 2025. The New South Wales government has approved a plan to build 12 gigawatts of new renewable energy, and the firm ITK Services says that could cause all three Latrobe Valley power stations to close by the end of the decade. And regional Victorian footballers will find out tonight if they'll get the chance to play in the AFL after the league's national draft. Selectors face a difficult task after many players did not play an official match all season. For more news at any time, you can visit www.abc.net.au/news.
Thanks so much, Rio Davis, there with news headlines. Now let's head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Senior forecaster on duty is Keris Arndt. Afternoon, Keris.
G'day, Nikolai.
Unless I've been misreading things horribly, it seems relatively quiet at the moment.
Oh, you got that from the forecast? No, you're absolutely right. It is very, very quiet for the next few days. look, plenty of sunshine across the state today. There's a bit of cloud in the southwest and down kind of West Gippsland at the moment that has been kind of clearing off, breaking apart, and bits of blue are breaking through. Seen a couple of little showers down kind of Cape Otway, but that's about it for rainfall today, and we're not expecting much of it. Completely dry in the north with plenty of clear skies. A little bit warmer today than it has been over the last couple of days, a little wintry kind of blast. And that was the last of the cooler nights as well. It'll warm up a little bit over the coming nights. Now, there is a change that's moving through kind of later tonight and into tomorrow. It's the front kind of going through Tassie, not really affecting us too much, but just bringing some cooler air over us, a little bit cloudier in the south tomorrow, and some drizzly kind of showers about the south of the state. So anywhere south of the divide could see some showers from kind of late evening and then contracting to the east and clearing off during tomorrow. And look, at the most, kind of 5 millimetres, most likely up in the kind of Yarra Ranges or East Gippsland. Anywhere else in the south could see a shower, but unlikely to see more than a couple of millimetres. The southerly wind will hold up and it'll be feeling a fair bit cooler than today, especially in the south. It doesn't last long though. We're into much warmer conditions from Friday, especially into the weekend, as we get a big, very slow-moving high-pressure system move to the south of us on Friday, Saturday and Sunday. There's a lot of activity over, well, to our west in Western Australia, but that high is acting like a bit of a blocking system and it's stopping everything kind of coming towards us. So we're not going to see much of that, at least till fairly late on in this outlook period. And by that stage, there's not much of it left. So generally dry all the way through the outlook, warming up quite a bit. We've got approaching kind of low intensity heat wave conditions in the southwest of the state from Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So we're seeing temperatures up into the kind of low 30s throughout most of the state and some reasonably warm nights as well from later in the weekend as we see it become a bit more humid. And then Tuesday we see the next chance of rain, and then even then it's not looking like much. There's a potential for quite a bit up on the eastern seaboard through New South Wales, but it's, at this stage the current model guidance isn't bringing it down over Victoria very much. And there's a change moving through on Tuesday which will bring some showers to the southwest, extending across the state on Wednesday and some cooler air, but again, nothing huge rainfall-wise, just more kind of variations in that temperature, Nicola.
Okay, just before we let you go, in terms of the wind side of things, as the grain harvest continues, do we have many windy days on the way?
Nothing obscenely windy like we have had over the last few weeks. Don't know if obscenely windy is a technical term, but, you know, very windy days. But over the weekend, kind of Friday, Saturday and Sunday, look like there's a bit of wind around up in the north of the state, enough to lift the fire dangers up to around very high. But even then, I mean, it's nothing particularly worrisome, maybe 20 to 30 kilometres an hour mean wind through those days and then easing off early next week. So, yeah, nothing too noteworthy.
Okay, thanks so much, Keris.
Thank you.
That's Keris Hart, senior forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology.
The Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailharts on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 21 to 1. Well, between a global pandemic, souring trade relations, we've already talked about this lunchtime, closed borders, you do look back on the past year and it has been one of incredible change. But for the agricultural sector, at least according to the National Farmers Federation, the industry's voice in Canberra, things haven't been too bad. Here's President Fiona Simpson on the industry's progress over the course of 2020.
At the moment, it is amazing, I have to say. Depending on where you live, obviously, Australia is so diverse and some areas are still very dry. Some areas up north are waiting for their big, hopefully, fingers crossed, summer rain. But at the moment, there is a buoyant mood, I have to say, in agriculture. There's lots of young people coming into our industry, getting involved in our industry. We seem to, after a lot of hard work, starting to finally change some of the messaging and the conversation in the media about our industry, and there is a lot of positivity about it. That said, and today, you know, we're launching our report card, and it's showing some positive signs, but it's also, of course, showing some headwinds and some challenges that I think we'll always have in an industry where we're so highly dependent on other factors.
I want to get to some of those challenges in a moment, but we've heard from the government this week. It expects Australian farmers to produce $65 billion worth of food and fibre this year. Still a bit of a way to go before hitting $100 billion over the next 10 years. Do you think the industry is on track?
Yeah, look, we hope we are. And certainly, I think the figure is amazing when we come, you know, reflect on what it was like 12 months ago. And I think
$61 billion.
Largely, of course, probably due to the change in seasons across much of our eastern cropping belt, which has allowed cropping farmers particularly to grow one of the biggest winter crops on record. And I guess also, you know, livestock prices, we've seen some great growing conditions.
Do you think that livestock prices have got too high?
Well, no, I think I was actually just reflecting on the price in the supermarket the other day. And I think, you know, at the moment, at the price of livestock totally dependent on the availability of them, who wants them, who's buying them, and, you know, that is the market. So people who have livestock to sell.
So could you afford to buy steak, or were you going veggie?
Oh, no, I was actually thinking it was actually not so, I didn't think it was as outlandish actually as it was when we were only getting a dollar a beast. I think the price of the livestock reflects the market, reflects the availability of livestock. If people have them to sell, then obviously, you know, they may well have had to pay an enormous amount of money to get them through the drought. So they're probably now benefiting.
Well, the return to seasons has been welcomed across large parts of the country. The story of 2020 really has been the coronavirus pandemic and the influence of China on the trade. You know, the Australian Meat Industry Council says a third of meat exports have been lost. We know that cotton's been targeted, lobsters, wool very nervous at the moment, the wine job. Basically, there's not anyone selling anything to China who isn't nervous about it. What on earth do you do about that?
Well, you just buckle on down and you just keep doing what you do best. And we keep concentrating. We know in Australia we grow a product that is regarded, you know, so highly regarded worldwide that everybody wants. And so we try and focus on influencing what we can do. And
so should we go to the World Trade Organization over the barley tariffs?
Well, we have to. In Australia, we're way down the track in terms of the size of our country and the size of our agricultural production. We're not, you know, one of the top superpowers. We're down at number 13 or 14.
So is that a yes or a no?
Oh, well, absolutely. We depend on playing by the rules. We have to, and we have to support that whichever market we're dealing with. And so in the case of the WTO or any dispute that we have with any market, there's a whole process, which in the case of barley, started, you know, a couple of years ago now, where we went through the different processes in the different countries, and we still absolutely stand by our claims that the Australian barley industry is not subsidised or not, and not and we haven't dumped. So,
but don't you run the risk of further aggravating China when it comes to other exports?
Well, Xi Jinping is on record as saying that he plays by the rules, and in actual fact, China has taken cases to the WTO before. And so for us, the
WTO... Australia has never taken China to the WTO since CHAFTA over an ag commodity, I don't think.
No, and I think we've been able to, and I think that points to the strength of the relationship that we've had with China, which in the case of barley goes back to 1960s. But in the case of the WTO, it is just a matter of if we have been unable to, if we've gone through all the processes we possibly can, if we still stand by what we say, if there is still some dispute, then let's kick it off to the independent umpire, and that's the WTO. And that's, I think, ultimately it's the grains industry that will advise government on that, but certainly that's the attitude of the NFF.
Do you think that the government has done enough to support producers to find new markets?
Well, we're continuing to talk to government about that, but what I know...
That's another yes-no question too.
Yeah, no, well, look, the government can always do more. We always want more, we always want more markets, and we always want to deliver more products, and there's a whole thing around non-tariff barriers and, you know, discussions. It's not just opening up the markets, it's then getting in our products. And so I know we're the envy of the world in terms of how many markets we actually deliver to and the sorts and the variety of produce that we deliver. But we're talking to government right now about, let's look at some of our other neighbours with developing middle classes as well, and how can we get targeted products in there.
And what about talking to farmers and exporters and having an honest conversation to say, you know what, we've had a really good run of it with China. It's bought more in terms of volume and value than pretty much anyone else is prepared to pay, and it's going to be a very long time before we see another market like that.
I think people have been having those conversations for some time, and I actually think that some industries have done a really good job in the last couple of years of actually recognising the risk of putting all the eggs in the one basket with a country that is so different to ours, a different culture, a different political system. And, you know, it does when, you know, it's a hugely returning market for us. And it's a real win-win for China and us as well. But I think, you know, it is a risky market. It's always risky putting all your eggs in the one basket. So we need to, you know, and farmers are very aware and exporters are very aware that they need to develop those relationships in every country.
Fiona Simpson, I understand you met with the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, this week. Did he let you know who he's going to appoint as the new Trade Minister?
No, his lips were sealed. It seems to be one of the biggest secrets around here at the moment. And Simon Birmingham has done a great job. It's going to be big shoes to fill.
That is the National Farmers Federation President Fiona Simpson speaking with Kath Sullivan. A longer version of that interview with Fiona Simpson, including some more details on things like labour shortages, funding for biosecurity, and also the progress of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, will shortly be up on our website at abc.net.au/rural.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it is 13 to 1. My name's Nikolai Bailhart. Well, the dairy industry's national advocacy body, Australian Dairy Farmers, is recruiting only weeks after its AGM. It wasn't particularly smooth sailing for the group's voting members, and its national council must now plug the gaps. There's a board position to be filled, but no word yet on when an announcement can be expected. President Terry Richardson spoke here about the meeting with Peter Somerville.
It allowed a high level of engagement, and I think that would be the most members that we've had in attendance, albeit in a virtual presence. So out of that, we had one new board member appointed, Queensland Dairy Farmers Organisation President Brian Tesman. He was elected as the new business director. And I'm, of course, looking forward to working with Brian on our board.
You've just had your AGM, you've appointed Brian, but there's still another board position vacant just after the AGM. How did that situation arise?
There were originally four candidates who stood for the board, and there was one candidate received enough votes in his favour, in this case Brian, to be elected to the board of directors. And each candidate was the subject of separate resolutions, And as per the ADF constitution, any resolution that receives more against votes than for votes, that's not passed, and that's why we now have a casual vacancy.
How will you fill that?
So there's one direct position to fill, and as per the ADF constitution, the National Council appoints a person to fill that casual vacancy until the next AGM, and it's up to the National Council to appoint a person to this casual vacancy.
And where's the National Council at with that process? When could that be finalised?
So we hope to have that finalised very soon. I can't give an exact date, Peter, but I would hope within the next 2 or 3 weeks.
So they would possibly go through the candidates and find someone they think that has the skills for the job, or what do they consider?
Well, that's up to the National Council to determine. You know, it's provided for in the Constitution, so they will appoint somebody, and they will determine the person and how that appointment will be made.
Okay, and I understand that there was some problems with the actual voting system, that some people were entitled to vote twice but were only able to vote once. Is that correct?
So we did experience some difficulties at the AGM in conducting the vote, and the meeting was placed on hold while those issues were addressed. And how that came about was that some resolutions required the state dairy farmer presidents to cast votes as individual members and as state representatives, and this required them to use separate email addresses in this case. And as soon as this was discovered, we worked quickly to address it. But more importantly, we've been assured by our legal and governance advisors that the AGM was conducted in accordance with the ASIC requirements around virtual meetings, and that the final vote count is correct.
There were some constitutional changes up at your AGM. What were they, and were they passed?
No, the resolution which concerned a constitutional change was not passed. That was defeated.
What was that resolution?
That resolution was looking at the nomination process for people who want to put their names forward for consideration by members as board directors.
And just very quickly, you mentioned just before that this is a good way to get your members engaged. How many members do you have? How many were voting?
We have 370 members, and of course the state members as well. That's the state dairy organisations.
370-odd members. How is that tracking? Is that number stable? Are you looking to increase it?
Oh, we're always looking to increase membership, Peter, and we rely on our state members also to assist in this regard and encourage their members to become members of Australian Dairy Farmers.
Why would a dairy farmer listening sign up? What do they have to do, and what do they get out of it?
Well, they become part of the national organisation, which is involved in policy development and advocacy for national issues. It provides them an opportunity to have direct communication and linkages with the national organisation, as well as with their state organisation.
That is Australian Dairy Farmers President Terry Richardson speaking there with Peter Somerville. ABC Sport.
Grandstand summer of cricket continues with the T20 International Series, Australia versus India.
Oh, that's a blinder of a catch!
Every ball, every catch.
Taken, the catch behind!
Every wicket.
It's all over.
All the excitement from the T20 International Series live at the ground. Grandstand summer of cricket, live on ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
$7.50. $70.
Thank you.
Here you go.
That does mean it is time to head off to the livestock market, starting today at Wodonga with Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. 250 cows and 30 bulls sold to only a couple of buyers. Quality remains quite good, with most cows well covered. Demand weakened 4 to 5 cents. Heavy cows 273 to 298. The middle run 260 to 278. Dairy 222 to 258. And the better shaped bulls 285 to 313. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Now to Hamilton and Chris Agnew.
Thanks, Nikolai. This is an interim report, as still one third of the sale is yet to be completed. Agents have yarded 60,214 new season's lambs at Hamilton this week. The offering of lambs ranged from plain to excellent, with the similar weight range to the last sale last Wednesday. However, this sale displayed far better quality overall to be the best offering so far this season, with the lambs in the 22kg plus showing the better quality, as well as some lightweights suitable for the trade. There was a full contingent of processors and restockers in a sale which was dearer over all categories. The heavyweights and lightweights were up to 15 dirha, the medium weights up to $10 dirha. Light 12 to 18 kg lambs, 107 to 148, averaging 750 to 950 cents. Light trade weight lambs, 18 to 22, 136 to 179, averaging 730 to 770. The medium trade weights, 22 to 25, made from 169 to 219, averaging between 730 and 800 cents. Heavy trade weight lambs, 26 to 30, made up to $252 per head. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much, Chris. Now let's head to Warrnambool and Eric Estrone.
Warrnambool agents penned 831, averaged a very good quality cattle, 109 more, for a mainly usual following of buyers. Milk vealers sold 10 to 15 cents cheaper, but yearlings moved from 20 cents cheaper to 20 cents dearer, especially for the stronger restocker interest. Grown steers remained equal in prices, but grown heifers were unchanged to 20 cents lower. Manufacturing steers lost on average 15 cents, cows were a general 10 to 15 cents lower, and beef bulls gave up 15 to 20 cents, while the dairy bulls held firm. Steer milk vealers sold from 395 to 416 cents, restockers paying 370 to 422. The heifer vealers to the trade made from 350 to 406 cents. Restockers paid 350 to 400 cents for yearling steers and from 350 to 373 cents for the yearling heifers. The trade paid from 310 to 370 cents for yearling heifers. Grown steers sold from 319 to 336 cents, manufacturing grades 260 to 290. Beef cows sold from 275 to 310 cents, dairy cows 245 to 280, leaner cows 240 to 250. Beef bulls were from 282 to 285 cents, and the dairy bulls made 245 to 260. It's been Eric Estrone reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Eric. Now to Lee Guther and Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Nikolai. There were 530 fewer at 1260, with the usual buyers operating in a mixed market. Quality was good, although more limited, with cows representing almost half the sale. Trade cattle sold to firm demand. Grown steers lifted 10 cents. Heavy bullocks eased 7. Friesian manufacturing steers eased 15 cents. Crossbreds held firm. Heavy beef cows lost 18 cents. Dairy cows were firm to 5 cents off, with processors loading cows for an estimated 517 to 560 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls eased 5 to 20. Grown steers 375 to 390, mostly to feed. Bullocks 340 to 383. Heavy Friesian steers 275 to 311. Crossbreds 275 to 365. Most light and medium weight cows 185 to 262. Heavyweights 242 to 280. Heavy bulls 248 to 306. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. And now to Horsham and Graham Pymer.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lamb supply halved and sheep numbers are up a little this week at Horsham. 4,250 lambs, 4,950 sheep yarded. Quality was more mixed over the lamb run, with more young lambs being shorn. User buying group and tenure operated in a mostly firm to slightly dearer market. Heavy lambs sold to 225, and the trade weight sold from 170 to 196. They've averaged 745. Shorn lambs sold from 163 to 192, to average 730. Restockers and feeders paid from $110 to $163. The sheep penning covered all weights and they sold the steady competition. Heavy sheep sold mostly firm. Lighter sheep lacked competition to be easier by $10 to $15. Not all the regular buying group were active. Heavy crossbred ewe sold to $232. Heavy merino used to $216. Merino weather sold to $194. By trade weight lambs, 18 to 22 kg, sold from 148 to 166 to average 760. The medium trade weight lambs 22 to 24 kg sold from 170 to 184. They've averaged 745. Export 3 and 4 score lambs 26 to 30 sold from 196 to 225. They've come in at 730. The medium sheep 18 to 24 kg sold from 59 to 163, with a run of merino mutton averaging around 600. Heavy hoggets made to 172. Heavy rams sold to $70. And Graham Pinewood Horsham from LA.
Thanks very much, Graham. And for today, that is the Country Hour.